one life, never more to me. Can that melody fill my heart with the joy? What's it new? Night of bliss, night of tune and love, beneath the stars, amid the roses. Oh, dream of delight that faded at dawn, oh, song of songs. Oh, night of bliss, when you were my whole world of love, when you
was Satima B. Benjamin from her new album, Windsong. She's from South Africa and will be performing in Philadelphia November 19th at Temple University's Minton Hall. It's a minute after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. Well, with me for a return visit to Fresh Air is writer and filmmaker John Waters. He's the only filmmaker I know of who ended a movie with a 300-pound drag queen eating a fresh dog turd, just one of the reasons why he's known as the master of bad taste. His films are frequently shown as midnight movies. Pink Flamingos played for years at Philadelphia's TLA Cinema on South Street. All of Waters' movies have been super low-budget independent productions, except for Polyester, which was backed by a studio. Waters has a second career as a writer. His new book is a collection of essays called Crackpot, The Obsessions of John Waters, and we're about to find out about those obsessions. And Crackpot has just been published by Macmillan. John, welcome back to Fresh Air. Good to see you again.
It's good to be here.
I've never heard you read, and I thought it would be terrific.
I've never done it. So, and I have to do it tomorrow night in New York, so maybe this is my run-through. This piece is called Hatchet Piece, 101 Things I Hate, and it's sort of a joke on myself in the worst possible mood I could imagine. I wake up on the wrong side of the bed and smoke my last three cigarettes. I know it's going to be a bad day. My hair hurts. That cloying voice of the FM disc jockey, one, has already gotten on my nerves subconsciously. I smash down the alarm button and realize the very air I breathe is not good enough. I've had it with being nice, understanding, fair, and hopeful. I feel like being negative all day. The chip on my shoulder could sink the QE2. I've got an attitude problem, and nobody better get in my way. Before showering, I kick the furniture. I'm in a bad mood, and the whole stupid little world is going to pay. I'm not even going to make the bed. The one rotten, suffocating set of polyester sheets, too, I still own is thrown in the garbage. I happily destroy the ozone by spraying on my favorite aerosol deodorant and sneer at the dumbbells he used in nauseating roll-on brands, three, the kind that retain stray underarm hairs from past use to remind you just how imperfect the human body really is. I get the newspaper from outside the door, hoping I'll catch the creep who sometimes steals at four when I oversleep, but throw it down in disgust when I see color photos, five, that never reproduce properly and look like 3D comics without the benefit of glasses. Then the damn light bulb burns out, six. Does General Electric think I'm made of money? I gotta get out of here. I think I'll just drive around town yelling insults at pedestrians. On the way down in the elevator, I'm confined with an unattractive neighbor and his slobbering dog, seven. I look away, grumbling, knowing that every time you make direct eye contact with these creatures, your IQ drops 10 points. I don't see any cats, eight, thank God. I assume they're all in other apartments sucking the breath out of babies, or worse yet, in heat, forcing you to use a Q-tip on their private parts to shut them up. I check the mailbox, but naturally the mail's not here yet. I hate it when the mail is late, nine. Lazy bastard mail carriers are probably reading my postcards and leafing through my magazines at this very minute. At least it's not one of those stupid holidays, ten, like Washington's birthday or Columbus Day, that brings any work you might have scheduled to a screeching halt. Outside, it's hot and muggy. I buy a carton of cigarettes, ever bitter that I'm taxed so highly, 11, on the one purchase that actually brings me happiness. They ought to tax yogurt, 12. That's what causes cancer. A neighbor, who always seems too familiar for her own good, passes me and makes the mistake of saying, "Good morning." "Shut up," I snap, making a mental note of her hideous tube top, 13, and ridiculous Farrah Fawcett hairdo, 14, so popular with fashion violators. And then I see it, a damn damn ticket on my car, even though the meter, 15, has only been in effect 10 minutes. I have to take out my rage on someone. I run towards this fashion scofflaw. She gets into the most offensive vehicle known to man, La Car, 16, and yank her door open as she frantically tries to lock it. Not so fast, miss, I bark. There's a certain matter of this ticket you'll have to take care of. $16 for gross and willful fashion violations. She gives me the finger and peels out, turning up the radio so I hear the voice of the worst-dressed man in music, Stevie Wonder, 17, braying in my ears. Glaring at anyone who dares look at me, I get into my own car, an American sedan, and purposely ignore those ridiculous seat belts, 18, that makes you look so stupid, so overprepared, so paranoid. Who wants to be trapped in an overturned car about ready to explode, fumbling for the buckle? Oh, Christ, I need gas. What else can go wrong? I pull into a gas station, and wouldn't you know it, they only have self-service, 19, pumps. I don't want to know how to fill her up, thank you. Humiliated at having to perform this unavoidable task, I see another motorist who has tried to disguise his bald head by stretching his one remaining strand of hair over his skull in a misguided camouflage attempt, 20. Ha! Does he think he fools anybody? Have a nice day, baldy, I shout as I sign the credit card slip and hop into my car. Pulling out, I swerve to miss a slightly overweight jogger, 21. It's not working, I scream at this sweaty hog. I make the mistake of flipping on the radio, but all I can get are those awful talk shows, 22, that feature lonely, militantly stupid listeners calling up professionally obnoxious hosts to vent their idiotic opinions. Don't they have friends to bother with their inconsequential views?
That's great.
That's now there is a chapter called 101 Things I Love. Also, there's the other side of that.
It's the equal time sequel.
Right, right.
That essay is from 101 Things I Hate, written by John Waters and published in his new book, Crackpot, just published by Macmillan Press. You know, you do have a second career as a writer now. You've been writing for a lot of magazines.
Yeah. I write for Film Comment, American Film, Vogue I'm writing for now. Which I find.
Is this why all this fashion stuff has filtered into
your writing? I wrote this. The Vogue is only recently. I mean, I reviewed Liberace's new book in the one that's out now. And then I reviewed.
Is it good?
Well.
I've always been wondering what it'd be like to interview.
It's called the Private Wonderful Life of Liberace. Wonderful it is, private in it. It is not. In this book, he claims that he has never had a facelift, doesn't wear a wig, and
never wear sequins.
Yeah, that older women are more a challenge to him sexually now. Well, you know, I'm not Helen Keller. But it's a funny book. I mean, the pictures and everything. And he's building this place called Liberace Land where you can actually live in a diamond-shaped condominium in Liberace Land. Which I'm considering retiring and moving there.
And he'll be like the Liberace pro in residence?
Yeah, well, they're going to have all his movies showing, all his costumes displayed. It's an entire, like, Disney World. He's going to have a perfume
it's
out
a theme
called Liberace.
Park about him.
Yes, a doll, everything. That's I mean, you great. Can devote your entire life to Liberace worship.
You know, reading your new book, which I really enjoyed, it strikes me that your writing isn't as self-consciously tasteless as a lot of your movies are. You're very ironic about things.
Well, I think Polyester had a little more of that in
yes,
it, certainly.
Definitely.
I think that I've always tried to move in that direction from the very beginning when we had to get people's attention. We were coming at it. We were a little group of people in Baltimore making a movie when underground movies were already over with then, and you had to compete with the regular movies. We had to do something to... It wasn't even that calculated, though. I mean, I try to look in hindsight and think that, but basically it just is what happened at that time. I guess I had a lot of rage in me at that age, which I got out with some humor involved at the same time.
Do your editors ever worry that you're going to send in, you know, filthy,
no.
abusive stuff?
Well, I try. Certainly with Vogue, I'm not going to put in something that I'm, what, you know, it'd be ridiculous. Editors have encouraged my insanity, where movie producers say, will it play in Peoria? When to have a hit book, you can appeal to a lot less people than a hit movie.
Does it bother you that certain magazines have language restrictions?
I have had very little problem with that. I was amazed at some of the stuff they did print, if you want to know the truth.
Really?
Yeah. I have, the only thing Esquire once would not let me print the word yuppie. It's the Y word.
Oh, don't say it on the show. Don't
say it. Because it's a yuppie magazine, so they
right.
will not print that word.
Uh-huh, it's self-denigrating
yeah.
to them.
So that was a censorship hassle.
Hmm.
I know with Hail Mary, which is a chapter in here, American Film got more hate mail than the history of their magazine. But editors will never admit this. They love to get hate mail because it shows that the people are reading the magazine.
Are you working on any new movies?
Yeah, well, I signed a development deal with a investment banker in New York, and I wrote the script. I've done the three drafts of it. I've done the polish. I've turned it in. He likes it. We're doing the budget now, and we're going to shoot it in the spring. I'm very hesitant to talk about it because, A, I know this business, and nothing's definite. B, you'd have to talk about something for so long after you do it that being a Catholic boy, I think it's a venial sin to talk about something. You know what a venial sin is? That's pimples of the soul. A mortal sin blackens it. And I'm afraid lightning will strike him or something, and it won't happen. So it's sort of a musical, and it's sort of, I say. And it's about hillbilly teenagers, their white trash parents, and their quest for mental health, which I realize is a vague plot thing, but I'd sort of like to keep it that way for now.
Well, I was going to ask you if you wrote it, but I'm sure now that you wrote it.
Oh, I wrote it, certainly. I would never make a movie I didn't write.
You really wouldn't?
No, because writing is the most fun of it. When you write a movie, thinking it up is the best. From then on in, it's downhill because you have to compromise. It never turns out as good as you want it to be.
I feel like I've seen some movie makers start on the real fringes and then happily work their way into the mainstream. And the person who really stands out in my mind for that is Wes Craven, the horror movie.
Yeah, I think more than that, David Lynch, certainly, who went from Eraserhead to Dune. I mean, you're talking about going from a tiny budget movie to a huge budget movie.
But his new movie, Blue Velvet, is still a pretty personal
film,
whereas Wes Craven's new movie is...
I haven't seen it.
Pretty bad.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
But that wouldn't be you working your way into the mainstream.
Well, my ultimate goal is to sneak my most pernicious ideas into the most mainstream product I can possibly do. Yes, it is my goal, as long as I can do it the way I want to do it.
What posture do you take when you're in Los Angeles trying to pitch your ideas to the moguls? Do you try to show that you're very ironic about this stuff?
Well, the main thing you try to show the moguls is that, A, all your films have made money. B, that your idea is not going to have somebody eating turds, which they all fear.
Right.
When I go to the pitch meetings, one thing I love about it, at least they tell you right away. You go in and pitch this thing. The hard part is getting the appointment. Do it. Once you're in there, you have 15 minutes. I got up, I did a dance, I talked the whole thing, and they tell you right then yes or no. If they say yes, your agent says get out before they change their mind. And then you come back, right? You have maybe about three meetings. If they say yes, it takes about a week, where independently you have to go out with cocaine-addicted dentists for a year of lunches, and then they tell you no. So at least they tell you, even though if they say yes, you know that the movie will end up having nothing to do with your basic idea in the long run. You will have to homogenize it so very, very much. And what always happens with me, the movie I'm going to do almost happened at a studio. But the head guy always comes in and says, let's watch Polyester or Pink Flamingos. And as soon as I hear that, I know it's over with. Because watching that by yourself, they just flip out. They don't get it. With Polyester, the guy looked at his watch and said, this is funny? You think this is funny?
He didn't like it?
He totally didn't get it at all.
How do you dress when you're going for one of these Los Angeles movie meetings?
Well, you try to look like an eccentric movie director, you know, which is usually... Levi's, a tie, and an expensive sport jacket, I think, is the L.A. Pitch look, certainly.
I love the picture of you on the back of your book. You look kind of like a very sinister model for GQ.
Right. I think it looks sort of like a 30s picture.
A horror host
or
something. Yeah.
I did it when I was actually on a tour with Polyester, and this woman, Valerie Santagato, took the picture in Santa Fe and sent it to me, and I had it for years, and I just thought I would do something with it. And then I sent it to the book people, and I said, I don't know, is this too much? And they loved it. I mean, I thought maybe they wanted me in a crew neck sweater, you know, the writer look.
This is the sinister movie, though.
Right.
Your films are out on cassette now, right?
Yep.
Tell us a story about what happened the first time it was going to...
Well, Pink Flamingos had been out, and it always causes trouble still. Because even certain video shops have a letter they send around of warning the people, if you don't want trouble, don't carry these 10 films, and Pink Flamingos is one of them.
Well, because the people who want to get your store closed down will...
Period, yeah.
Focus
I mean, they're just saying if you're not asking for trouble, you can get away with straight porno, but don't have Pink Flamingos.
Why are your films considered worse than pornography?
Because of coprophagia.
Which is?
The eating of a turd. I'm trying to be, on radio,
I'm
trying to be gentlemanly.
Too naive to know these words.
That, I think, is actually in the laws, law books. And I've heard in the Mies Commission, there's something about someone having sex with a chicken, which I hope it's not Pink Flamingos, because that was certainly simulated. I haven't read the Mies Commission. But that, excuse me, when you watch Pink Flamingos in a courtroom, it looks obscene. Without that good audience sitting around laughing at it, a jury is afraid to laugh. They'll be busted. I mean, you can't sit there on a jury and be yucking it up when something's on trial for obscenity. So it really looks horrible in a courtroom.
Have you gone to see it in a courtroom?
No, but I know people that have. And I read the police report in Phoenix that was great. It was like Dragnet. They sent a cop to the theater, and the whole movie is written like, it opens, film opens, white female sitting in playpen, girdle and bra. And he has to describe it, and he gets to points where he can't. He says, what appears to be a woman takes a steak and hides it in her underpants, and, you know, and goes through this whole thing, and it's hilarious because not once can he break from this police jargon. And it's funny, but I can't play in Phoenix anymore, so it's not that funny in the long run to me. But the other films would happen, two of them, Female Trouble and Desperate Living were coming out, and this one company had the whole ad campaign, which I love, which I helped think up, called Let's Get Trash Back Into the Homes Where It Belongs. And this whole thing, and what I heard, and this is not, I don't know for sure, but the jobbers and salesmen in the Midwest, which is one of the most important video market in the country, is the Midwest for a reason I'm not sure of, saw the film, you know, because they're going to sell it, and refused to sell it, said, no, we are not selling these movies. So they canceled the whole thing. But then, because of the publicity we got from that, another company came along, Continental, and actually gave us a better deal. So, you know, everything when censorship has always in the long run helped me rather than hurt me. If you want to censor something, shut up about it. Don't talk about it.
Do you spend much time watching your older movies?
No, I hate to, because all I see is the mistakes. The only time I like to watch them is in foreign countries when they're dubbed. I went to Japan this year, and they all opened in Tokyo. And they weren't dubbed there, but still, to see it, they had subtitles, Japanese subtitles. But in Japan, they don't cut scenes, but they have censorship. What you can never show is pubic hair. That's the only thing. You can have a snuff film. It's all right, as long as no pubic hair is showing. They have this little optical ball, like in Phantasm, the horror movie, that comes down on your crotch and stands there. But it's really done well. Like, if a person just turns 1 degree and you can't see anything, the ball disappears. But as soon as they turn back for one frame, this ball comes flying back. So it's really strange. It must take hours and weeks to put this little thing in.
Maybe there's people who specialize in doing that.
There must be. It's an industry.
When you're
crotch watching.
When your films are dubbed, are they dubbed in the same kind of non-inflection
way
that the kung fu movies are
dubbed?
Well,
no. I heard in Germany, I saw it, and they actually hired a man to play Divine's voice, which I'm not sure was a good idea. And they had an old lady voice for Edie that was nowhere as good. But actually, the Germans threw in jokes that weren't even movie that got great laughs in the audience. You know, so I couldn't believe it. There were things where I said, what's everyone laughing for? There's no joke there. And they told me what was translated. And it was an in-German pun or something that would have never translated, right? And they just put them in, which I thought was great.
That's great. My guest is John Waters. He's a filmmaker and author. He's got a new book called Crackpot, The Obsessions of John Waters, and it's just been published by Macmillan. Do you not own a TV yet? You allude
no,
to the fact
I own
you didn't
one and a VCR, everything. I'm a 1986 kind of guy now.
How did you live for so long? How did you watch charity telethons and religious
programming
without a TV? I never
watched them. I hate them. And the other day I was on a dentist with laughing gas, and one of them was on the things, and I couldn't get her attention to take it off. I'm sitting there asking for money the whole time. It was true torture. I got a TV. Somebody gave me one for Christmas. And I do like Pee Wee Herman's morning show very much.
I think
it's brilliant.
When I look at it, I think that you did the casting for it.
Oh, well, Shirley Stoller's in it. Who, you know who she is? She was in The Honeymoon Killer. She's the fat woman.
Oh,
she's the one that was on Broadway, and they always say she looks like Divine. The reviews always
people
get
say
met her.
I think she looks more like Edie,
yeah, I
really.
Met her. She said, yeah, finally I met a real woman. She was real nasty to me, but I'm still a big fan of hers. I think the set, I think it's really hilarious.
Oh, I think it's great, too. But I really think of you when I see it, because for our listeners who haven't seen it, it's a kid show.
But now they're going to run
it at
night,
too. Yeah. But usually
on
the kid show, it's like the benign people in the neighborhood, the nice people who stop in. But all the people are crazy. They have these big teased hairdos.
I know.
These baggy flowered smocks on. And they're.
It's a great show.
They all look like they're in John Waters
movies. It's a reason to have a TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked, of course, Lie Detector, which is no longer on the air, which was F. Lee Bailey's show where they had criminals on. They gave him a lie detection test, and he'd say, you liar. And so it was amazing.
What else do you watch?
There's a local dance show called Shakedown, which is maybe like Dancing on Air, which I try to watch whenever I'm in Philadelphia. Is that still on here?
I don't know because I'm always on the air when it's on.
Yeah.
I think it is.
That's a show I like. I like local dance shows in each city. Other than that, sometimes I'll watch a late talk show, but not too much. Because I go to sleep. I like to read, so I read every night. That's how I relax. It's really the only way. TV makes me nervous to have that voice coming out. I think, of course, as I've said a million times, it's really an ugly piece of furniture. Why can't they have great-looking TVs? They don't very much.
Well, I think it's the same reason why they have such lousy sound. Something hasn't caught up yet.
But you'd think with design, at least they could have a great-looking television that wouldn't make look good sitting in a room, even if you turned it off. That's the main reason I hate it, because they're so ugly.
I figured that if you watch a lot of TV, you could maybe find some stars who you liked as much as Pia Zadora, who you've always said you wanted to cast in one of your movies.
She has my script now. We'll see.
Does she really? Yeah. I was wondering if you'd keep your word on
that. Yeah, well, we've sort of friends now. You know, I've gone to see her. I saw her at the Kennedy Center. I saw her. And we're in touch, you know. She said in Spin Magazine she wanted to be the new Divine. So maybe, although I want Divine to be in it certainly, too. I think they'd be great as enemies.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, I can hardly wait.
She may not, definitely may not say yes. We'll see.
It's not going to hurt her career.
I think the critics could go for it. I mean, it's a villain part, you know, and I think that the critics could maybe certainly responded well to Tab Hunter, who had gotten certainly not always great reviews.
She's not on the verge of losing her audition for Ophelia.
Well, she said she never wants to make a
movie
again. She said
really?
That she doesn't want to ever do movies anymore. She said that if the show Lonely Lady on national television, she's committing suicide. So I think that she really had enough of that. I mean, she has a good sense of humor about it. She has to, you know, because, but Butterfly I liked. I mean, come on, it has Ed McMahon in it with Oscar Wilde. What's his name? Citizen Kane. Orson Welles, Pia Zadora, and Ed McMahon in one movie together. Come on. That's a classic of sorts. Mm-hmm. A James M. Cain novel to boot.
You still go to a lot of exploitation movie houses?
No,
to see
not
movies.
So much anymore. There's a new one opened in Baltimore that I want to see. I love the ad campaign. It might be a terrible movie. It's a slasher movie, and it's called Chopping Mall, where shopping costs an arm and a leg. Right. It's a great ad. No, because I think the golden age of trash is over. Hollywood makes those kind of movies now, and it's not as much fun when they cost all that money.
Some of the movie houses have gotten pretty scary because...
Some of them in Baltimore always were.
Really?
It's scarier to wait in line than to see the movie.
I understand in some of the houses you get frisked now on the way in.
I believe that. There's a thing in Baltimore they have a midnight, dusk to dawn show inside called the Fight and Fright Show, which literally you go in and fight and watch a movie. I don't think they plan it. They mean because it's karate movies. But basically the audience took the ad campaign a little too seriously.
And there's vermin walking around in some
houses.
Oh,
I see rats in lots of movie theaters in every city.
Well, did you ever feel like a potential victim in those theaters?
Once I was in a theater and somebody on the other side of the thing yelled, "Hey, what are you looking at?" And I was nowhere near looking at him. And I thought, wait a minute, it's not worth getting punched to watch Ashanti or one of these movies. But basically, I'll still go. There's one, I mean, I love the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2, and I don't understand why it was a huge flop. I thought it had the, did you see it?
No.
The sets are incredible. And it's a satire on the first one. That was my favorite exploitation movie of the year. Three movies I've liked without restrictions this year was that one, Salvador, and Blue Velvet.
You like Blue Velvet?
Very much, yeah. I thought it was funny. I think it's a great comedy.
I think it's pretty funny, too.
Yeah, I mean, I laughed a lot in it. I mean, there are parts that are kind of shocking, which is great. I haven't been shocked by a movie in so long.
Well, part of the times when I was laughing, I felt a little bit like the people who you were discussing in the jury, you know, screening
right.
your movies and thinking, feeling like a real pervert
yeah.
laughing at the stuff because
yeah.
you're not supposed to be laughing.
But
at
I
it.
Think that he meant it basically to be a comedy. I mean, some of the scenes in it are just amazing. I mean, I love all the little town footage that looks almost like some movie you saw in school or something.
One thing I found is that if you go to an exploitation house to see a horror movie, and you're dealing with the audience as much as you're
yeah.
dealing with the movie, that if you have an ironic stance about the movie, if you think it's like fun trash,
yeah.
it's hard to maintain that attitude with people who seem to be seriously identifying with the monster or the rapist or the killer or whatever.
No, I think it makes that, but that's the only kind of movie where I don't mind audience participation, when they yell out these comments. I mean, when I saw Friday the 13th, part 82, whatever, and for some reason, I go to see every one of those movies opening day, and I never like them. There's something in the ad that hypnotizes you. Why? It's going to be a TV series, you know, now.
Oh, really?
Yes. Can you imagine?
I've run out of numbers for
yeah.
the sequels. That's why.
But I want to direct the final one, the 13th one, to have guest stars that they kill in each place, you know. Esther Williams with an axe, Rudy Valley with a chainsaw, and just, like, do it like Wonton Ton or one of those cameo films. What were we talking about? I forget. Something about...
Audiences and expectation movies, how you really like it when
they
yell up at
the
screen.
Well, when I was seeing Friday the 13th, somebody was... Because I'm shocked by it sometimes. Somebody yelled, "Hey, man, I want to see some green," they yelled. And I didn't know what that term meant. And that meant gore. And somebody yelled, "Slit your own wrist, blankety blank." You know, and there was this banter going back and forth in the whole theater, which kind of made it more amusing than the movie really was. Of course, I'd hate to see Salvador in that movie theater, or Blue Velvet. Or, as a matter of fact, I got in a fight, two fights when I saw Blue Velvet, because I saw it in suburban Washington on a Friday night with a crowd of dates from suburbia, and they talk in the movies, which makes me insane. And I was in a bad mood anyway, and I was sitting by myself, and every time something would happen, the girl behind me would have to say something. Finally, she said, "Is he going to go through that door?" And I turned around the loudspeaker and said, "Yes, he is. We just saw him do that." And then I was afraid her boyfriend was going to punch me in the mouth. And then she said, "If you don't like it, go to the movies by yourself." And I said, "Believe me, if I could see this movie without you, I would pay my last nickel." And then she stomped out saying, "This movie's sick." And then he wanted to stay. And then she came in and tried to drag her date out. He wouldn't leave. So there was a real ruckus. I mean, those kind of audiences make me insane. Because they watch VCRs too much. They're used to talking. I don't want to hear that. Be a critic if you have something to say about it. Go home and sell it to a paper. But I don't want to hear your views.
Do you go by yourself to the movies?
Yeah, I like to go by myself. I like to go on the day, too, because there's usually less people. It's usually empty. I don't know about here, but in the daytime matinees, they're never very crowded.
There's usually the discount matinee that's crowded and another.
Yeah,
that,
I like to go to the 4 o'clock show when its cost is more and is less likely to be people there.
Well, did you ever have this prohibition in your family that if you shouldn't go to the movies during the day, you should be outside in the sunshine playing?
Well, in the summer, no, you couldn't go to the movies and drink out of the water fountains. You'd get polio. I remember that.
The other reason why you weren't supposed to go swimming,
right,
too.
Right.
So you're better off in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
John Waters is my guest, and you know him as a filmmaker. He's also written a couple of books. His new book is called Crackpot, The Obsessions of John Waters, and it's just been published in hardcover. Do you go see pornography?
I don't go out to see it.
Well, I meant out to the theaters.
No, not to the theaters, certainly. I think they're really a dying breed because of video. Every once in a while, I love porno titles. I think they're hilarious.
Give me some examples.
I don't know. Can we say them? I mean, like, there was Bimbo, Hot Blood Part 2, Romancing the Bone, The Sperminator. You know, I mean, those kind of, In and Out in Beverly Hills. I mean, all those titles they do.
They're all puns on mainstream movies.
Yeah, or hilarious. Once in a while, yeah, I rent porno. But it's always good for the first 10 minutes. And then I sort of think, oh, then it becomes like a medical film. And then now it's hard to watch without thinking of AIDS and all these things. They totally ignore that in these movies.
What about the theaters, though? I thought you might be interested to see what the theaters are like.
I really believe that porno theaters today are a place to launder mafia money. I believe that some of these theaters, there's nobody in them. They could never open. But I think they report that they did $100,000 that week as a place for money to come in a cash business. Yeah. Because most people, to be honest, go to pornography to masturbate, and they don't do it in movie theaters unless you're really kind of, you know, rude patron. So I think that pornography has put them out of business.
You write a little bit about drive-in theaters in your new book, and the one thing that made it hard for me to think of you at a drive-in theater is that I've come to think of drive-ins as a very suburban experience.
Well, when I was growing up, they were the passion pits. I mean, that was the first place to have sex, the first place to get drunk. I was arrested in a drive-in once.
For what?
Underage drinking. It was really embarrassing. I mean, they ripple wine. That's what was embarrassing. I also always used to forget to take the speaker out and rip the window out of my father's car. I mean, or sneak in the trunk. I would drive in by myself, and there'd be like 10 cases of beer in the back with blankets covering it, and all the people in the trunk. I mean, I had good teenage memories from the drive-in. And we'd see the same movie every night. We would literally go every night because that was where we could go party.
Did you watch the movies at all?
That's where I got my film education because during those years, which
you're
I would say...
You're supposed to be having sex there, though, I thought.
Well, it was hard to have sex watching Blood Feast. Then they had people that patrolled looking for you to stop you have sex. They would shine flashlights in the
really?
Window. Yeah. But... I saw, this was around 60 to 64 is when I was heavily into the drive-in. And that was the golden age of before porno. It was the first Ghoulie movies. It was Herschel Gordon Lewis, all those Russ Meyer films, nudist camp movies, all that stuff was then.
You know what I saw in drive-ins?
What?
The Diary of Anne Frank.
Baltimore was sort of the South.
Pocketful of Miracles of Frank Sinatra.
No, well, I saw Robin and the Seven Hoods with Frank Sinatra. That's the one I saw 8 days in a row because we went every night for some reason at that time. But they had the real trashy movies then that played, quote, in the South, which Baltimore's always been confused if it was the South or the North anyway. But as drive-ins go, it was the South.
Can I reveal something that you tell in your book?
Sure.
That you won a twist party at a country club when you were a teenager.
Yes,
I thought this was the greatest revelation in your book.
Because there was this show that, see, we didn't get Dick Clark because in Baltimore we had our own version of it, the Buddy Dean Show. But it was the same thing. They became local stars and everything. And they were the kids that my parents would never allow me to hang around with. The girls had beehives, the boys had DAs, and they were kind of the rough kids. But they were huge stars. I mean, they were like 14 years old with like white lipstick, Elizabeth Taylor eye makeup, Cleopatra eye makeup, black nylons, pointy toe fruit boots. That look, I thought they were great. So, yes, I went to I could only go to the record hops, and I did win a twist contest. I think that was the last time I danced. I still have the album.
So you were good at it, huh?
The twist, oh yes. The only time I do those dances now is after maybe three martinis in the privacy of my own apartment with very close friends.
Did you, you're kind of obsessed with hairdos, with teased bouffants.
Yes, we'll have to tell you about
beehives.
This new place I've discovered in Baltimore. Firstly, that's even disappearing in Baltimore. It's being replaced now by the Farrah Fawcett do. The people that had the beehives now have that 1970 Farrah Fawcett do. And you can walk in at a McDonald's and say, hi, Farrah, and they go, hi. They think it's a real compliment. But there is this beauty parlor that I've discovered that it's called Chantel's. And it used to be a massage parlor, and it's just open. And I park my car sometime there and eat lunch and watch. And people come out with the largest hairdos. And I don't even know where they live because you don't see them anywhere else. Giant, like 5-foot ones with 6 falls cascading behind. And I'm convinced there's a secret cult somewhere in Baltimore where there's one little block where everybody has that hairdo and they don't mix with anybody else and only sit around and talk and spray their hair.
But you know that there are some fashionable people in New York who seem to be bringing big hair back in, like Tama Janowitz. Have you seen the cover?
Oh, yes, yes. And I know. Yes, yes. But that's a different look, certainly.
Those aren't the falls. It's big hair.
Yeah, it's big hair, but it's not teased like a board, you know. And I've even seen that. But that's too self-consciously bringing. These people that have it are serious, and they think they're the straightest people in the world. They wear no makeup usually with that look, and a house dress, and a giant hairdo that would be maybe fit to wear to the Kennedy inauguration in 1962. But they always have that, and it's just kind of amazing to me. I don't think you can bring it back. A young person in the punk kind of spirit to laugh at. I don't think it works.
Did this stuff appeal to you as a teenager? Did you think it was,
oh, yeah.
Sharp?
I didn't collect baseball cards. I used to draw juvenile delinquents and on the back list their crimes, who they live with, where they're expelled from schools. And that's how I would play, imagining the horror of their lives. And I wish, as I reached a certain age of teenagerism, I was embarrassed for anybody to see them and I destroyed them. And I wish I hadn't. I had like 20 or 30 of them.
They go for a lot of money now.
Well, I don't think I would sell them. I'd just like to maybe frame them and put them in my house.
Well, you still do stuff not unlike that. You still have your Charles Manson file, right?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Who are you keeping files on lately?
Well, there's one thing that I could talk about, but I don't want it to be taken as sort of shock value because this is my new sort of thing I believe in, is that I'm... have been in touch with one of the Manson girls, Leslie Van Houten, who very possibly may get out soon. And I really think she should. I mean, she's not a Manson girl anymore. She's a 38-year-old woman that is totally rehabilitated, looks back on that with disgust, horror, everything that everybody that's listening hears. The prosecutor even thinks she should get out. He's trying to keep her in because of public opinion, but he's saying that she's the only one he will ever let out. She has a huge support group, job offers, everything. And she's been in that jail longer than anyone in the whole jail since she was 19 years old. And I'm kind of hoping that she can get out very soon and working with a group that's trying to get her out.
I'm thinking about people just tuning in now, and they're probably thinking I'm talking to a lunatic.
No, but that's why I don't want that to be taken. You know, that if you believe people can change. I mean, she was only along the second night, not the Sharon Tate murders. She's not charged with millions of murders. If she didn't go, the crime still would have happened. She met a madman when she was 19.
John Waters is my guest. Oh, this is a good time to introduce the fact that you also confess in your new book to secretly having a passion for art movies.
Oh, yes. I sneak in them to the way businessmen go to see dirty movies, definitely. Especially Bergman, because he always had the best vomit scenes. I pride myself. I want to do a book, The History of Regurgitation in Swedish Cinema, because they started it.
And, did they really?
Yes. And that period of movies I like very, very much. The Swedish shockers, like I, a Woman, My Sister, My Love, and all the fake Bergman movies.
Which are the fake ones?
Well, those movies. And all the ones that, you know, when Bergman came out and got international success in Sweden, they tried to just make all these adult shockers, especially My Zetterling, whose movies I like very much, Night Games, and those movies from that period, Inga.
She's got Therese a book out, Isabel. Marzetta,
yes, it's a good book. I read it. I liked it. Yeah, All These Tomorrows.
So what are some of the other recent art movies you've liked?
Let me think. I saw one based on a Jim Thompson novel. What's the name? It's a French coup de torchon? Yes.
You liked that?
I did like it, yes.
Oh, I hated it.
Did you?
Yeah.
I liked it very much.
Really? How come?
Yeah. Well, I love the novel. I love Jim Thompson's novels very much. And I thought it was a pretty faithful. I love Stephanie Audran. I love her. I liked Isabel. Was she in it?
No.
No. Who was in it?
I don't remember. This is directed by Bertrand Tavernier, who did Round Midnight, which is about to open.
Yeah, I haven't seen the new Menage, which I think I may like, Blier's new film. I liked Hail Mary.
You're one of the few supporters of Woody Allen's Interiors.
Yes, I liked Interiors very much. And I saw it again, and I still think I'm right. If it hadn't been a Woody Allen movie and it had subtitles, it would have gotten rave reviews.
Do you like his comedies?
Yes. Sometimes I like them better when he's not in them. I think he's a very good writer. Yeah, I liked Hannah. I liked his movies, yes.
Did you see...
I'm not fanatical about them the way New Yorkers are.
Have you seen Down by Law yet?
Yes, and I liked it very much. Yes, I saw it at the New York Film Festival.
Do you know Jim Jarmusch? Are you part of this scene?
He was in Tokyo. I'm not part of that scene, no, but Jim was in Tokyo when I was there at a film festival. And I know John Laurie I've known for years.
What about the art house experience, the art house movie-going experience?
Well, I think that, you know, the trailers they have for the movies are terrible when they have, like, just quotes saying, a masterpiece, Archer Winston, the New York Post, or I'm in love with Laura Antonelli, Rex Reed, come on. I think they should have trailers like exploitation films. You know, see B.B. Anderson, slit her wrists, or watch a movie that's 6 hours black and white with subtitles, or that kind of thing just to push them. They have very little humor about it. And when you go to the films, you can't laugh. People get mad if you laugh. They think if they're foreign, and you can't laugh. And of course, I don't like films to be dubbed. But although I think I'm going to pick up foreign language from watching a film, my only word I can speak is Das Boot from 20 years of going to foreign films. So, I mean, but I like to go see those kind of films. I think some of them, artiness can be, if it's taken far enough, I enjoy it.
John Waters is my guest. You pay tribute to William Castle in your new book for his sense of showmanship. What are some of the great things he's done in his movies?
He started with a film called Macabre, where he arrived at the theater in a casket. And then you had to fill out an insurance policy for $1 million of death by fright. Then he had a skeleton in House on Haunted Hill that came out in the audience on a wire, and people threw popcorn boxes at it. But my favorite was The Tingler, which had buzzers that went off under your seat. Then he had Coward's Corner, which was they would stop the film and say, are you too chicken to see the ending of this film? But if you wanted your money back, you had to follow yellow footsteps up the aisle that were stenciled in while you were bathed in a yellow light to a yellow cardboard chicken's corner that was in the lobby set up while a nurse, and you had to fill out a thing saying, I am a bona fide coward. I mean, it was really hard to book his films. You had to work for weeks to set up all these props. But after that came out, his daughter called me. He's dead, William Castle. We had dinner together, and she showed me the pin that he gave her to wear to the opening of Homicidal, which was a bloody butcher knife, and I wanted it so much. I'm so jealous she has that pin. But she should keep it. It was her father.
Was Odorama, which is what you did in, you had your scratch and sniff card for polyester, was that an homage to William Castle?
It certainly was. It was a joke on the whole idea of doing that kind of thing.
They really don't do anything like that anymore. The closest I can think of is for Earthquake. Remember how the...
Sense Around, that was great,
I think
they could do it with every movie.
Well, the bad thing with Sense Around was that the theater that really shook was the one next door in the shopping mall.
Well, you shouldn't go to Twins anyway. But they could do it. I mean, with Gandhi, you could close the concession down and let people starve to death. I mean, every film, you could think up a gimmick to make it more of an exciting event. That's why with Hail Mary, with all the pickets... the owner should have thanked them for coming. It got it on all the news shows. It turned this obscure French film into an event.
It got Jean-Luc Godard on Entertainment Tonight.
Yes, I know. So more publicity. And, I mean, how can they not realize that? It's amazing to me. Someone in Baltimore was carrying a sign that said, "Don't insult my mother." And I'm still trying to figure out, was he Jesus? I mean, did he think that Mary was his mother? I don't know.
Well, it's one of your lifelong ambitions to be in the National Enquirer, right?
Well, only because the National Enquirer is the ultimate barometer of fame. You're only truly famous if you're in there, which means you have to be on a TV show to be really famous in America. I think that, you know, they've got headlines like Barry Manilow, "I've got a big nose and love it." I mean, I think that's delightful. I don't think they harm anybody. They embarrass celebrities. But I don't know. I laugh when I read the paper. I mean, I think that sometimes when something happens, I think, oh, I can't wait for 2 weeks while the Enquirer does it. You know, what are they going to do with this story?
You could get in it, though, easily, don't you think?
No. Mm-mm. You have to be super famous to be in there. They're not going to care if I was getting divorced or any of those things. You know what I mean that they write about? You have to be really super famous to be in there.
But you could be one of the believe it or not.
Oh, yes.
Features.
I could maybe call it and say I had sex on a flying saucer or something. You know, but that's not the articles I like in there. I like the one where they had, oh, no, Jackie O. She wears same outfit 4 years later. And they actually had a picture of her in an outfit, and then she had made the mistake of wearing the same thing 4 years later. Well, that meant to get that story, they had to keep a file on what she wore for 4 years until she wore something twice.
How about writing for them? Have you thought of that?
No, because I don't think they'd let me do it the way I'd want to do it. You have to do it very straight. It pays more than almost any paper in the country to write for them, though. But when you have to move to Lantana, Florida, and there's incredible competition amongst reporters between themselves to get these stories. And I think you make a lot of money, but it's a very, very hard job. You have to bribe bartenders and that kind of thing.
You know what I couldn't tell from some of your writing? If you actually hang out in some tough places...
Sometimes
in
I do,
Baltimore.
Yeah. I mean, like, I go to this place called the Wee Wee Hours in Baltimore that is an after-hours place for mostly, like, hookers and hustlers and biker gangs and everything. And I do go there, but with other people. I would never go there alone. And you just have to be nice to the meanest people in there, and they'll protect you. It's like going to jail to go there, but it's amazing to watch. All the women have tattoos, and it's fun.
They all have teased hairdos also?
No. They just have tattoos and... all different kind of hairdos. You know, it's very 1980s. They're younger.
Have you learned how to act really tough when the circumstances require it? Because I should mention you've taught in prison for a while.
Yes, but how you get through any tough situation is to make somebody laugh. That's the ultimate armor. If you can make somebody laugh, they like you.
You know what the problem is sometimes? That if people don't share your sensibility, you could crack what you think is this really funny joke that's just going to, you know, have them falling out of their chair, and they'll think you're crazy and not funny.
Well, you can be crazy in those places, too, when they leave you alone.
Right.
Just don't be arrogant. And basically, I think that I've had enough experience talking to crazy people that I can do it without being forced, and I'm generally interested in what they have to say, which I think most people, they're amazed that someone really does want to hear what they have to say, and I think that is the ultimate equalizer, if you really can listen to somebody.
And you're not someone who would be perceived as a do-gooder.
And I'm hardly going to judge them. I'm not there as a judge. They could tell me anything, and I wouldn't say that I thought it was right or wrong, because that's not going to make them not do it. But yet, when I was teaching in jail, if they thought I was taking something the wrong way, like they'd say, "Who's your favorite new killer?" I would say, "No, you're wrong. That you're taking it wrong. That isn't what I mean." And I try to be conscientious with that job. I thought it was a serious job, certainly.
Well, how did you explain your interest in killers to the killers who are actually in prison who you were
well,
teaching?
Well, I told them about that the trial is what interests me, and what interests me is how they deal with what they've done later, how they handle the notoriety, how they handle all this, and if it's still possible to ever laugh. And they could understand that. Because I never asked them what they did. I didn't really care what they did. They'd tell you if they got to know you later.
Mm-hmm.
We made a new film this year that we hadn't made since probably the last time I talked to you. It's not in the book. Called Rotten Apples. And they wrote it. We both wrote it together. It was just video, black and white video, no editing. It was like my earliest 8mm movies because that's all we could do. But it was great because some of them played women, you know, and because there were no women. And everything was fine as long as we put a blanket over the door so none of the other inmates saw it. And it never left the prison, which was fine with me. And I think it was a pretty good little movie. We had fun doing it.
Yeah, I guess
it was the only movie I made this year.
John Waters is my guest, and his movies include Polyester and Pink Flamingos. His books include Shock Value, which is autobiographical. And there's a new book of his collected essays that have appeared in places like Rolling Stone and Film Comment, and the new book is called Crackpot. John Waters' films are very popular in Philadelphia. Pink Flamingos played for years as the midnight show at the TLA. So I thought I'd open up the phones and give our listeners call and talk with you. So if you'd like to talk with John Waters, our phone number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215. The number again is 923-2774. The film that you made at the prison, which you didn't want taken out of the prison.
Well, it was one of the rules from the warden that it was not allowed to be taken out, which I understood.
So you couldn't take it out either for a retrospective of your movies?
No, because, you know, this is people's lives. This is people that, And I told them right from the beginning that I would also never tell their stories, which I never have. It's not in the book. Because
okay.
I felt that would have been sort of really exploiting them, and I didn't want to do that.
Are you teaching there anymore?
Well, I can't this year because I'm on a book tour. You have to be there every Thursday. You know, so I'd like to do it again, certainly. But I only want to do it when I can definitely do it right.
Right. Well, let's take our first phone call, and I think we're ready to do that. Our phone number is area code 215-923-2774. My guest is John Waters, and I think we can take a phone call. Yeah, okay, we'll take the first call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, this is a compliment, not a comment or a question. I listen rather faithfully to your broadcasts and find them all interesting, but some are more interesting and off the wall and offbeat than others, and John is one of your more particularly interesting and amusing and insightful and intelligent observers of American culture.
Thank you very much.
You know, it's just too bad that more people don't hear what you say and, of course, listen to what you say, because, of course, we're living in an insane asylum called contemporary culture.
Yes, I agree, but sometimes it's a nice insane asylum. I don't think of it badly or that everything's terrible. I'm an optimist, certainly.
Well, I look at it perhaps slightly different. I wouldn't quite want to say I'm a pessimist, but I do realize that the anxiety and tremendous sense of negativity that I feel when I go around the country is because people don't realize exactly how insane most of our cultural conditions are. And if they would realize that, they would laugh, make fun of it, and liberate and free themselves and reduce this level of anxiety that they feel all the time.
Thanks a lot for your phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yeah, I don't want to come across as though I've got a preconceived notion. Okay, so you just correct me or tell me what you think, Mr. Waters.
Okay.
I was a little younger than I am today, and I saw Pink Flamingos. And I got to I can't believe I'm going to say this, but, you know, I found it disgusting.
I think that's certainly a valid response to that movie.
Well,
I see it now. I'm disgusted by part of it.
Well, that's interesting. Let me ask you something. In a world which is just rife with horribleness. I mean, all kinds of physical horror, mental horror, nasty, cruel crap. Do you think you had to make Pink Flamingos? I mean, did we have to have that on the library shelf? You know what I mean?
No, you didn't. And that's why I was successful. Because it was an unneeded thing to happen, and that people saw that film and thought, God, can you imagine if my mother saw this? That was part of the appeal of the movie, that it went to such extremes. And yes, I think everything can be awful and ugly, but if you can't change that, what should you do, stay home and be depressed? You have to laugh at it if you can't change something. I don't think that's sick. I think that's healthy.
Well, thanks a lot for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I heard one time that Tim Waters was going to try and make a movie out of A Confederacy of Dunces. I was wondering if you had any plans for that in the future.
No, they didn't. It didn't happen. I don't think anybody's made the movie yet. It was the only thing I ever wanted to make that I didn't write, and I went to Hollywood for the meeting, and the story's in the book. It was really a horrible story what happened, that one of the producers I never heard from again, and I found out that one of the prisoners that I was in touch with had killed one of his friends, which was maybe the worst Hollywood meeting that ever happened. I felt very, very terrible, but it's the kind of thing that's so awful that, you see, I just heard you laugh, and it's the kind of thing that's so awful, what can you do?
Is that why it didn't happen?
Well, I'm sure that's not the only reason. I'm sure they screened Pink Flamingos like what always happens. But I'm sure that this was not a great help to my image with this man when thinking about hiring me. And I don't blame him. I mean, I certainly think he probably made the right decision.
Right. Well, thanks a lot for your call. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was listening to an interview, and I really enjoyed it. And I was surprised that Mr. Waters was such a sensible person.
Thank you. What'd you expect?
I was like to know your opinion of the movie Salvador. I saw the movie, and I've been following the affairs in Central America. And
well, I thought it was a great movie because not only its politics, but I thought beside its politics, it was a very, very entertaining movie. I thought it had some great comedy in it. I thought James Woods was great, and I thought even Jim Belushi, who I'm not a rabid fan of, I thought turned in an amazing performance in that film.
Also, where's the Wee Wee Hours Club? Is it safe to go there?
It's not safe, and it's on Eastern Avenue in Baltimore.
So our listeners want to go.
Right.
Bye.
Okay, thanks a lot for your call. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hello, I'm not calling to talk about the fate of the Earth or anything. I just wanted to know what John Waters' reaction was to the MOVE members thing here, since he was a fan of them in their earlier days.
Well, a fan is not a word I would use. I was certainly interested in that case very much. I went to the first trial. I think Ramona Africa, I certainly would like to meet. I bet she's not a laugh riot. But, you know, she was the only, she did not get a long sentence, and I think Ramona will not be in jail too long. She was the only person left to blame everything on.
Okay. Well, thank you for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi. I have never encountered John Waters anywhere but on your program. And all over these several years, I've been wondering, why would anybody want to go see this guy's stuff? It's so far out and weird. And I was thinking to myself, would dear little just beyond the yuppie stage me ever want to see Pink Flamingos? But I think, Mr. Waters, you totally justified your whole raison d'etre when you told that woman, you know, if you can't do anything about it, you might as well laugh at it.
Right.
I still don't think that I would ever go to see Pink Flamingo unless it came out to the main line where I live.
Well, it's on video. You can watch it in the privacy of your own home, and nobody will know.
I don't even have a color TV set.
Oh, well, you can watch it in black and white. It won't make any difference. It's a technically terrible movie.
Well, that's all right. I just think if that's what your aim is, to sort of elucidate life and say, come on, you've got to accept things. Keep doing what you're doing.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, bye-bye. It's funny, I always feel like we risk talking in a time lapse by focusing on Pink Flamingos, because you really did that so long ago.
Yep.
And your most recent movie, besides the prison movie, is Polyester, which is totally different in style than
it's,
your
it's
independent
movies. It's
the same
sense of humor, though, deep down buried, certainly.
But divine in it, instead of playing this horrible figure is a real Elizabeth Taylor as housewife type.
Well, Divine's the victim for the first time.
Yes, right. Yes. Right. So, and who knows what your new movie will be like? You won't tell us, and rightfully
no,
so.
No.
I respect that. I'm not. I'm not trying to casually get it out of you. No. Let's take another phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air. Oops. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, John Waters. I was wondering what your favorite weird thing in Philadelphia is.
Oh, do you have any?
Gee, you know, when I come here always, it's for one of these tours, so I don't really get a chance to go out and do those kind of things. You know, after I wrote this chapter in the book, the John Waters tour to L.A., I had offers from a lot of city magazines to come to that city and write the trashy tour. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm going to end up, I could do, you know, the trashy Michelin, you know, each city, the worst places to go. But then I thought that I would maybe be trapped in that. But just from riding around Philadelphia, it's my kind of city, certainly. I mean, I see people that look very, very interesting, and I've always liked it here. And the response to my work has been very, very good here, which makes me think that I'd get along here just fine.
Well, question. Did you have something you wanted to suggest to him to see?
Yeah.
Okay, where?
Okay, the Oregon Diner. It's at 3rd and... Oh, I hope I'm not plugging something.
Well, that's okay if you like it.
Okay, see, they have, like, these huge Rice Krispie treat walls. And a Venus de Milo against that. So
out of Rice Krispies?
No.
Oh, that would be great.
Sort of huge Rice Krispie treat.
Well, next time I hear, I'll certainly set up a dinner there. It sounds good.
Yeah, it's 24 hours, so.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Thanks for the tip.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. You going to continue to write journalistic pieces?
Oh, yeah. I like to. I like writing for the magazines. It's they give me free rein to go do these things that I would have done anyway, and people thought I was nuts. Now I get paid for it, and they say, oh, how interesting, how intellectual. When it's the same kind of thing I always did, only now it legitimizes it.
Did you need any legitimization for yourself?
No, but it's nice. You know, you get money.
That helps, yeah.
Sure.
You know, before we have to wrap up, who are some of your favorite writers, both in terms of journalism, you know, magazine writing, and also novels?
Gee, magazine writing offhand, I can't think. I mean, with novels, I certainly like a lot of James Purdy stuff. I like Jean Genet, of course. I like Ann Tyler. I like, who lives in Baltimore.
Do you know her?
Yeah, I've had lunch with her. Who else? Let me think. I like Margarita Duras. I like Denton Welsh is really my favorite writer. This year, a lot of his stuff has been re-released. Let me think, who else? Gene Reese. Gee, off the top of my head, that's what comes to it.
Well, that'll do. Yeah. Well, it was great seeing you again. Thanks a lot for doing
back.
The interview.
And
good luck with the movie. I hope it happens.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I'll need it.
And John Waters has been my guest. He's a filmmaker whose movies include Polyester, Pink Flamingos, and Female Trouble. He has a new book. It's a collection of essays, many of which have appeared in places like Rolling Stone and Film Comment. And the book is called Crackpot, The Obsessions of John Waters, and Crackpot is published by Macmillan. Thanks to all our listeners who called, and my apologies to those of you whose calls we didn't have time for. It's 5 minutes to 5 o'clock. All Things Considered is coming up at 5 from National Public Radio. I'll tell you what's happening later this week on Fresh Air, after which I can wish out of traffic.
On the Schuylkill eastbound, a 25-minute delay between Belmont and City. Westbound, 20 minutes in traffic between the Boulevard and Belmont. The Boulevard still jammed between Broad and Ridge, an overturned truck. The left lane is getting by. 95 northbound is at a standstill between Penn's Landing and the Betsy Ross Bridge because of an accident blocking the left-hand lane into New Jersey. A minor delay at the Walt Whitman tolls, then jammed on the downstroke of the Walt Whitman Bridge. Down to about 1:30 below that, we're in good shape. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by Pat Conroy, author of The Great Santini, and a new novel called Prince of Tides. Also at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Mary Wilson, one of the original members of the Supremes, who's written a new memoir called Dream Girl. Wednesday afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, Joseph Lelyveld will be my guest, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times and author of the book Move Your Shadow, South Africa, Black and White. We'll talk about his reporting from South Africa. Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock, Steadicam and Skycam inventor Garrett Brown will be with us. And he also did the Philadelphia Get to Know Us campaign, which has a part two about to come out. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Frank Furstenberg, professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, who has a new book called The New American Grandparent. This Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be bassist Percy Heath, so I hope you can be listening. Well, if you've been wondering where I was these past couple of weeks or what I was doing on All Things Considered, here's what the story was. I was invited to guest host for a couple of weeks, so I was down in Washington these past 2 weeks doing All Things Considered, and with those 2 weeks over, I'm back, and it's nice to be with you again. So stay tuned for All Things Considered, which is coming up in just 3 minutes from National Public Radio. That about does it for today's show. Ron Carson and Audrey Vablaitis are engineers today. Assistance from Marty Moss-Cohen, Amy Sallet, the associate producer, Danny Miller, and I, the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening.